As agriculturalists, we are constantly reminded of the increasing global food demand. One of the best illustrations of this that I have heard was by Pioneer's president, Mr. Paul Schickler, when speaking to the company's summer 2011 interns. He stated that in the next 50 years, we will have to produce twice as much food as has been produced in the history of mankind in order to feed the world. This is a daunting task, and it can only be accomplished by the constant development of new commercial crop varieties and hybrids. But this begs the question, who is responsible for the development of these new varieties? I firmly believe that the answer to this question depends highly on the crop and the situation. And this evening I will discuss three specific examples of this, including the role of the private industry in the United States, the role of the private industry in developing countries, and the overall role of the public sector. In developed countries such as the United States, with the advent of biotechnology, the private sector has a niche when it comes to high-dollar biotech trait-type crops. This is primarily because they have funding that, frankly, the public industry, public sector can't dream of. There is no use comparing a public research lab to a state-of-the-art, cutting-edge, private, big seed company research facility. I've seen it firsthand. In fact, my jaw literally dropped open the first time I walked into a private research lab. The amount of money they have to invest in discovery research, in biotechnology, it's just phenomenal. But that funding, it comes in part from their ability to maintain intellectual property, which essentially is what makes the private industry private. A prime example of this is the patenting of genetic traits in the higher dollar crops like corn, cotton, and soy. In today's market, it's not really even optional anymore for growers to purchase anything but seed that has these traits if they want to be competitive, with other growers. In fact, according to the USDA, about 94% of soy, 90% of cotton, and 88% of corn in the United States that was planted in 2011 contained biotechnology traits. And while these traits come with a price tag, the revenue that the companies gain from these is turned right back around into more research, which benefits the growers and the world by increasing their yields. In some cases, when it comes to traits like insect protection, the increased productivity of these crops with the trait can be up to 80% when it comes to things like rootworm protection in corn. It's just great. And that's really where the private industry is responsible in the United States, with the higher dollar, primarily biotech type crops. Private corporations also play an important role in developing countries such as Mexico, where currently the majority of seeds provided by farmers is from the federal government. And while this government provided seed is better than the available land races, it still leaves much to want. Unfortunately, the local subsistence farmers have little choice but to buy their seed from the government agencies without a large private industry there. For this reason, Dr. Ronald Cantrell, the former head of CIMMYT's maize program and the former director general of ERIE, emphasizes the importance of programs like CIMMYT and the CG system to really support the local, small, private seed companies in these developing countries where the current primary source of seed is from the federal government. By CIMMYT and other groups supporting these companies, they effectively provide the local people with improved plant material that is of a much higher quality than the government or the public sector is able to produce. And this really boils down to the fact that competition is what drives innovation. And without innovation, you can't have improvement. And this is why the private competitive companies are important in developing countries. Finally, I'll touch a little bit on why the public industry is important to the big picture. And I would say it's important in two major ways. In the research, production, development, of other crops that don't have a large biotech market, and in the training and education of future plant breeders. When it comes to other crops that don't have a large biotech market, the public industry is where the majority of improvement comes from. For example, UC Davis leads in the release of oat varieties. Colorado State has released over 30 improved wheat varieties since 1964, and Michigan has a substantial dry bean program. And these programs really are the only sources of improvement for these and other crops that remain untouched by the biotech-driven private industry. In summary, there is really no one answer to who should be responsible for the development of our new crop varieties and hybrids, as my question asked. According to the World Food Program, there are over 925 million people who go hungry in the world every day. And without the constant development of new crops, improved varieties, that those people are going to continue to go hungry and the number is just going to go up. And it's really up to collaborations between the public and private industry, as well as their own independent efforts to provide the mandatory food for the world.
Our next speech is going to be by Rebecca Harrison. Her topic is current and future relationship between agriculture and the high quality drinking water supplies. Again, her name is Rebecca Harrison, and her topic is current and future relationship between agriculture and high quality drinking water supplies.
Imagine a United States with only very small amounts of water that is safe to drink. In the majority of our country's supply, there are contaminants, overexposure of nutrients, and pesticides in our drinking water. And the numbers of death caused by this issue that once upon a time nobody believed could happen in our country have risen exponentially. Such a problem was only possible in other countries, perhaps those underdeveloped or those lacking sustainable agricultural practices. But it is now our sobering reality. Thankfully, the said scenario is fictitious. But such will become a country, even an entire world, if more is not done to understand the essential symbiotic relationship agriculture has between land and water. The importance of clean, high-quality drinking water is common knowledge to many. What is not common knowledge, however, is how to achieve or maintain that kind of a water supply for all people, just like you and me. Equally as important is understanding how agriculture affects our drinking water. So, how does that system work? For starters, water is pumped from its source and used in crop irrigation systems to help these essential crops grow, crops that eventually turn into shelved items in our local grocery stores. During this actual growing process, however, crops are sprayed with pesticides, herbicides, nitrates, fungicides, nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus, as well as other products at the farmer's interest that would all be considered contaminants to water. After being irrigated, the water is soaked into the soil to keep the plants alive, but also to be recycled back to surface water and groundwater, taking all of the chemicals into the groundwater with it, systems that we use for drinking. The question is, when will we run out of water free of contaminants dangerous to the human body? If fresh surface and or groundwater is used for crops and recycled, always taking new chemicals with it back into the water systems to be used again, will this vicious cycle that should be considered a peaceful, symbiotic relationship ultimately deplete our clean water supply? Currently, we are starting to see the signs of pollution and contaminants in our water supplies at the hand of this love-hate relationship. About 40 to 49 out of our 50 states have some combination of nitrates, petroleum products, pesticides, volatile organic substances, and metals in their water. with already 5 million people around the world dying annually due to waterborne disease, this number will surely increase if the regulation of chemicals applied to our soils that end up in our water system is not increased. Steps have already been taken to protect this precious resource, such as the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, regulation of pesticides, and help coming from USDA farm bills. However, we cannot rely only on government motion to fix the entire problem. Protection of water needs to be a global movement if clean water is something that everyone will still want in the future, a highly probable situation. Education is the first key. It is dire that more people understand the inevitable effects agriculture will have on world water supply. Once we can understand, action is the next step. Using better farm management practices, like implementing new technologies, research and development, and/or using safer alternatives to conventional synthetic pesticides, such as biopesticides, will have a huge impact on reducing and ultimately eliminating the chemicals that we will put inside our body by simply having a drink of water. The next, and maybe most important step, is persevering through hardship in order to maintain these new methods of management. When an obstacle comes up, discouragement is not an option. Obstacles are the pathway to growth, and overcoming them, in this context, is the pathway to clean, safe water. Awa, Van, Wasser, Voda, Ama, water. It's essential for life around the world. It is a simple gem, a luxury to underdeveloped countries, an expendable resource to ours, and is always revered as the most basic of all human rights. Let us hope that one day safe water is not a thing of the past, replaced by a nice cold glass of H2O mixed with phosphorus, dangerous pesticides, and metals, all because we realized too late the influence agriculture has on our water quality. And may we all remember this simple and sobering quote by American poet W.H. Auden. Thousands have lived without love, not one without water. Most importantly, clean water. Thank you.
Does somebody want to check on the door, please? It's kind of closed back there. All right, our next speech is going to be by Molly Haas. Her topic is herbicide-resistant weeds are here to stay, so how do we cope? Again, her name is Molly Haas, and her topic is herbicide weeds are here, so how do we cope?
Herbicide-resistant weeds are man-made. It all started with 2,4-D in 1946. As herbicide science progressed, people discovered that they were a cheap and effective means for weed control. This has led to more and more use, which has led to misuse and overuse of certain herbicides, which in turn has led to single-gene resistance, multiple-gene resistance, cross-resistance, and metabolic resistance. In this speech, I would like to tell you about ways to manage herbicide-resistant weeds. These ways include chemical control, crop rotation, and mechanical control. To begin with, chemical control involves responsible use of herbicides. The first step in this is the use of multiple sites of action and modes of action. The site of action is where the herbicide kills the plant. For example, in the chloroplast or in the cytosol, whereas the mode of action is how the herbicide kills the plant. For example, carotenoid inhibition, EPSP synthase inhibition, or photosystem II blockage. Using multiple sites of action needs to be done, because using a herbicide with one single site of action can lead to resistance. The selection pressure exerted on the plant can induce gene change, and one gene change with one site of action can lead to resistance. Whereas when multiple sites of action are used, multiple genes need to change for resistance to develop. It works the same with the modes of action. To incorporate multiple modes of action and sites of actions, producers can use tank mixes. Tank mixes allow multiple MOAs and sites of action in one application, one pass across the field. Not only is this more affordable for the producer in application costs, but it meets our goal of lowering selection pressure. Another important thing to do when choosing a herbicide is to rotate the herbicide action. The herbicide action is how it is translocated or not translocated throughout the plant. For example, there are contact burners. Contact burners are not translocated at all or move only through the xylem. An example of a contact burner is a Photosystem 1 herbicide. Systemic herbicides, on the other hand, are translocated fully throughout the plant through the xylem and the phloem. An example of a systemic herbicide is glyphosate. Contact burners exert lower selection pressure than systemic herbicides because they are in and out and kill the plant very quickly. However, they do require very good spray coverage, and poor coverage can lead to resistance through selection pressure of the herbicide coming in contact with the plant but not strong enough to kill it. Systemic herbicides, unlike contact burners, exhibit a slightly higher selection pressure because it takes longer for the herbicide to translocate through the plant and reach all the tissues. Good coverage isn't nearly as important. The plant will die with a lower coverage rate. However, it will take longer because the herbicide has to translocate throughout the plant and reach all the tissue. Another very important thing to do in a herbicide management program is to follow the herbicide label. The rate is very important. The label rate is calculated to deliver a rate that will efficiently kill the plant, but not apply too much where it's going to cost the producer too much money. Another important thing to follow is the timing. It is important to spray weeds at the appropriate growth stage. If weeds are sprayed too early, there's not enough tissue to contact in the case of a contact burner, or there's not enough photosynthesis taking place for the plant to translocate the herbicide. Spraying too late also can have a negative effect. There's either too much tissue to get good coverage, or it takes too long for the herbicide to translocate through the plant. The final important thing to do in a herbicide management program is to do some follow-up scouting. Follow-up scouting is done to make sure there are no herbicide escapes and make sure your program is actively killing weeds. Another good thing to do to control herbicide-resistant weeds is to use a crop rotation. Crop rotations can consist of winter annuals, such as winter wheat, summer annuals, such as corn, beans, or again wheat, and perennials, such as alfalfa. This is good for the soil, and it's also good for controlling weeds. It suppresses weeds that have the same germination as the crop. It also suppresses weeds. Suppressing weeds in multiple crops equals less weeds overall and less seeds in the soil seed bank. The third point I would like to tell you about is mechanical control. In mechanical control, primary tillage can be used to control weeds. Examples of primary tillage include chisel plowing and disking. There is also other equipment that can be used. Primary tillage can only be done where the chance of erosion is minimal. It buries seeds deeply and prevents them from germinating. Another way to control weeds is cultivation. Cultivation can consist of rotary hoeing behind a tractor, between and in-row cultivation, and even hand removal of patches of weeds. This is a very good way to control weeds. When you're out there in the field and you see them coming out of the ground, you know they're dead, you know they're done for. However, mechanical control can become very expensive and labor-intensive. What method the farmer chooses to use just depends on their production plan. So herbicides may work for strip-till or minimal tillage producers. However, they won't be effective for an organic producer. In summary, herbicides are still a very good means for controlling weeds, even resistant ones. Crop rotation and mechanical methods are also effective means to manage herbicide-resistant weeds. Thank you.
Our next speech is going to be by Sarah Alford. Her topic is Introduction of New and Existing Plants and Animals. Are they safe? Again, her name is Sarah Alford, and her topic is Introduction of New and Existing Plants and Animals. Are they safe?
Imagine a world where there were no introduced species. To put it in a better perspective, imagine the U.S. with no soybeans and no hamburgers from cattle. There are thousands of introduced species in the U.S. Some are beneficial and some can be very harmful. So, is it safe for us to introduce these new and existing species? With the right tools and research, we can figure this out. An introduced species is any species that has been taken out of its native environment and put into a different one. And as I said before, some can be damaging and some are beneficial. The damaging species are called invasive species. They are adaptable, aggressive, and they reproduce very rapidly. They lack enemies in this new environment, and so they're really hard to control. There are many invasive species, so I have a few examples for you. One major invasive plant in the U.S. is kudzu. Kudzu is a perennial climbing vine, and its stem is semi-woody. It is invasive because it smothers out different plants with its heavy vines and its blanket of leaves. It spreads by rhizomes and seeds, which is why it is able to reproduce so quickly. It also grows about a foot per day. It was originally from Asia and was introduced into the U.S. in 1876 in Philadelphia. It was promoted as a forage crop, an oriental plant, and farmers planted it to control soil erosion. It became an invasive species because of its harmful effects in 1953, and it can no longer be planted as a cover crop. Along with your invasive plants, you also have invasive animals. An example is a wild boar. It was originally from Europe and Asia and was introduced into the U.S. in 1893 as a food source. Europeans brought the wild boars over and put them in hunting reserves, but some of them escaped and reproduced, and now we have a problem with them. They are so invasive because they damage crops and forests and are also very dangerous to humans and livestock because of their aggression. So now that I've told you about a few invasive species, I will move on to the beneficial ones. We usually call beneficial plants crops. Almost all of the U.S. crops today were introduced in some way. For example, we have wheat. Wheat is a cereal grain used for making bread, pasta, animal feeds, and other useful products. It was originally from Asia and introduced into the U.S. in 1602 in Massachusetts. It was grown for human and animal consumption. And now, it is a major food crop all over the world. In the U.S., we grow 53 million acres of wheat, and it brings $5.5 billion to U.S. agriculture. We also have the beneficial animals. For example, the Boer goat. And this is actually a very recent introduction. They are originally from South Africa and were introduced in 1993. They were brought over for meat and are today used for meat, pleasure, and show. This species is very dear to my heart because I've been raising boer goats for about 10 years now. Another introduced animal that is not used for food is the honeybee. It was originally from Europe and introduced in the possible 1600s. They're not sure exactly when the honeybee has come or came over, but there was a letter found that was sent to Europe saying that the honeybee had arrived with all of the other plants. It was brought to pollinate the other crops that were introduced to the U.S. and is now relied on heavily to do that same job. So, as we can see, introducing these species can be good or bad. So, if there is a possibility of it being a bad thing, why do we introduce these species at all? For plants, it is to tolerate pesticides, remove pests, become disease resistant, and increase yields. For animals, it is used for about the same thing: become disease resistant, pest resistant, and increase products like meat, milk, hair, and any other products that come from the animals. GMOs are being developed to do these things. This is a very controversial subject in U.S. agriculture today because some people think that they are harmful. In my opinion, we need to introduce these species and GMOs and help with these problems. A GMO is a genetically modified organism. Scientists take the normal plants and they alter their genes to deal with problems with pesticides and herbicides and things like that. Some statistics have said that there will be 9 billion people by the year 2050 in our world. In order to feed all of these people, we have got to introduce these species and use the GMOs. It has also been proven that these GMOs have increased our yield tremendously, and we cannot survive without them. Now, these GMOs and introduced species are heavily tested, and their first concern is safety, of course. So, in my conclusion, I think that we should use these GMOs and introduce these species, new and existing, to feed our world.
Our next speech is going to be by Jerry Single. Her topic is, are there downsides to genetically engineered crops? Again, her name is Jerry Single, and her topic is, are there downsides to genetically engineered crops?
The sun just breaks over the eastern horizon. It immediately sends golden rays racing in and out of each wheat head. The ripened kernels illuminate the same radiance and radiate in the golden sunlight. The farmer has stopped to observe his bountiful crop. He beams as though he was a proud father. He is pleased and satisfied with the work that he has done with his own two hands. The warm summer wind brushes across his face and he quickly snaps out of his daze. He realizes that he must tend to the rest of his chores and get on before the heat of the day. Like many farmers, the farmer in this story has grown up with a passion for producing crops. This is all he has ever known his entire life, and growing up, he was instilled with the mentality that not only was he producing food for the world, but also providing safe and quality food for his own family. As the farmer rushes off, he contemplates on a burning question in his mind that has recently turned the world that he knew upside down. Should he use genetically engineered crops to keep up with the fast pace of farming production, or is genetic modification really the best way to provide for his family? To take a closer look at the decision many farmers are faced with,
It is essential to understand just what exactly genetically engineered crops are. According to genomicsenergy.gov, genetic modification is a special set of technologies that alter the genetic makeup of organisms such as plants, animals, and bacteria. There have been many scientific advances in cell and molecular biology, and they have come together to form what we know of today as genetically engineered crops. There is much anticipation that biotechnology will allow plant breeders to respond more rapidly to increasing consumer demands. There are also other advantages that include improvement in crop yields, environmental adaptations, and quality attributes that can be specifically assessed. And this is on the Wiley Online Library. There are, however, a few downsides to genetic modification. One of the most prominent disadvantages is the refusal of acceptance of GM crops in the world market. For example, 59% of Australians and 51% of all French consumers have said they are currently not prepared to buy food with genetically modified components under any circumstances. Moreover, the share of those who reject such modified products in Germany has meanwhile risen from slightly less than one-third in 2001, is now more than 44%. This is from the Organic Food Quality News. Other examples of global acceptance as an issue would be the world not accepting biotech wheats and also the previously developed golden rice. Both of these examples are highly unaccepted due to the fact that they are both major food crops in the world economy. Another downfall to genetic modification is the potential escape of transgenes to its wild relatives. Allison Snow, plant ecologist at Ohio State University, says, quote, "Genes flow from crops to weeds all the time when pollen is transported by wind, bees, and other pollinators. There's no doubt that transgenes will jump from engineered crops into nearby relatives." She goes on to state that every transgenic organism brings with it a different set of potential risks and benefits. Each needs to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. But right now, only 1% of the USDA biotech research money goes to risk assessment, end quote. This can cause major health concerns if undesirable allergenic traits are passed between GM crops and its wild species. One more point to consider is the development of herbicide and insecticide resistance. There is already a debate as to whether Roundup Ready varieties are currently being overused, and certain selections of weeds have already built up a resistance. The next major threat currently affecting corn producers is the rootworm developing BT resistance. This is according to Kansas State Research and Extension. These could have catastrophic results if a disease or certain insect were to wipe out numerous acres of crops. However, these can be managed by proper rotation of herbicides and insecticides and correctly following refuge guidelines. Remember the farmer as he ponders over his bountiful harvest. The decision he is facing is one that will affect his life, his family's life, and more powerfully, the rest of the world. Genetic engineering is a powerful tool to improve efficiency and the nutrition of crops. There are several legitimate concerns of risk of GM crops that can all be assessed. Products must be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. The farmer and the rest of the world will have to decide if they will pass on the knowledge of farming that they understand and know to be safe, or are they willing to take many large steps in order to ensure adequate food supply for years to come. Thank you.
Our last speaker of the night will be Christy Thompson. Her topic is, who benefits in the global agricultural market system? Again, her name is Christy Thompson, and her topic is, who benefits in the global agricultural market system?
Imagine a scale of justice. Think of the two sides that are needed to balance out that scale. Now take that idea and paint a picture of a scale of justice with producers on one side and consumers on the other. The agricultural market system can be compared directly with a scale of justice. Producers and consumers alike are needed to ensure that the scale remains in check. Producers are in the market for three main reasons. They are self-satisfaction, to produce, and of course, to make money. Consumers are needed to keep this scale in check, not only at the local level, but also at the global level. 3 acres and a cow. This was a political slogan referring to what is necessary for self-sufficiency. Jesse Collings, an English politician and land reformer, in 1915 used this slogan. Within the past century, this slogan has held true for the majority of producers. The main goal of self-satisfaction is achieved through farming. Satisfaction comes from farmers knowing and also understanding what they are doing is feeding the world. According to Michelle Payne Knoper, 1.5% of Americans are farmers. Those 1.5% of farmers are being relied upon to feed the 98.5% of Americans who are not farming, as well as the rest of the world. What is more satisfying than knowing that you keep the world functioning? Producers are also in the agricultural market system to produce. According to the United States Department of Agriculture, in 2008, China's agricultural imports from the United States totaled $57 billion. It is quite obvious that producers are doing what they need to do. In 2010, United States corn production was at 12.4 billion bushels, with soybeans being the second highest on record at 3.3 billion bushels, according to the Corn and Soybean Digest. As farmers produce, they achieve one other main goal, and that is to make money. The global market system is completely tied together. Regardless of looking at the agricultural market, the crude oil market, or some other market, it is still apparent that they depend upon one another. Looking at this past summer, the stock market experienced some of the lowest prices seen in a long time. This was due to a cold, wet planting season. The rest of the world was uneasy because they were uncertain whether or not the United States would be able to produce enough. They were uncertain whether or not the United States would be able to supply the world with the commodities needed. About 60% of United States commodities are exported total. With any uncertainty in the global market becomes unstable. With turmoil in Libya this past summer in their internal government and also having a great supply of crude oil, the crude oil market became unstable, causing the commodity market to become unstable as well. Another great example of uncertainty in the markets is Greece. There was an internal economic breakdown of the country, and the global stocks reflected it. However, commodities do experience bullish periods where, if producers are intelligent, they are able to achieve their main goal of being profitable. Consumers are the other half needed to keep the balance system in check. A consumer is defined as a person who purchases goods and services for personal use, according to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Every person in the world is a consumer. Different groups of consumers can be found at the local and global level. Currently, there is a huge push at the local level for food to be grown and consumed locally. Global markets can be unsteady and unstable, with market prices fluctuating at large amounts daily. Through local production, this risk is eliminated, and the prices can stay somewhat more stable. The largest group of consumers is found in the global market. Approximately 42 billion pounds of food are consumed daily, according to the United States Department of Agriculture. Food is essential for survival, so the most obvious benefiter of the global market system are the people eating and using that food produced for other purposes. Agriculture allows for the development of cities, nations, and ultimately the industry. Agriculture feeds the world. Through producers and consumers alike, the agricultural market system can be kept in check. Consumers who produce locally and globally, or consumers locally and globally, rely on the producers who are self-satisfied, producing and making money. These two areas completely depend upon one another. If one group fails, the other will profit for a while, but ultimately fail in the end, just as the scales of justice would do. Thank you.